Gentlemen, 7 o'clock on a Saturday night, and as usual, that means it's time for the other podcast. I'm your host, Robert Stacy McCain.
And I'm the other guy on the other podcast. Hi, folks, I'm John Hogue, and I'm pleased to welcome the other lady on the podcast. Hi, Diana.
Hey there, John. Hi, Stacy.
Yeah, we're pleased to announce that Diana is now a full-time member of the crew.
And she's the best of my ability.
She's been regular.
Well, she's on the spot for the big story tonight.
Yeah, tell us all about it, Diana.
Okay, the rally is taking place out at the airport, which, by the way, is not a very big airport, but it's big enough for 747s at a pinch.
Be Air Force One.
Yes. I'm here to tell you that they had a parking area, absolutely huge parking area, out on a road called Potato Roll Road. I'm not kidding. That is an actual name.
Potato rolls are more of a Pennsylvania thing, but go ahead.
Don't ask me. I've only been here 2 years. I'm still learning. A lot of my friends are there. I've asked for texts. Nobody so far has texted. What else can I tell you? There has been an insanely huge rollout just in the last hour of, it sounded like every cop in Lowndes County. A whole bunch of the fire trucks, and oh, by the way, we had our Christmas parade down Patterson tonight. What can I say? It's a wild night here. We also had the first in-person 5K run this afternoon that we've had since March.
Okay.
So anyway, it's a very busy evening for here.
Well, it's also been busy in the football stadium.
Aha, yes. Saturday night during fall, as usual, it's time for my college football scoreboard.
Two good games today.
Well, yes.
Two very excellent games today.
Anyways. Let me go from number five, Texas A&M. Which has lost only one game, and that was to the undefeated number one ranked University of Alabama Crimson Tide. Roll Tide. But Texas A&M defeated Auburn.
An excellent game.
Yeah, 31-20. It was a little bit closer than that for most of the game, but there Texas A&M scored an extra touchdown, 17 points in the fourth quarter. And so it was 31-20 down there in the little village on the plains. Number six ranked Florida, which, by the way, their only loss was to Texas A&M. Florida 31, Tennessee 19.
An even better game.
Yeah, and because our good friend Mr. Hogue is a Vanderbilt alumnus, and therefore when Tennessee loses, he is happy. Let's see. Number nine, Iowa State defeated West Virginia 42-6. Number 19, Iowa 35, Illinois 21. Number 24, Tulsa 19, Navy 6. In the fourth quarter, number 22 ranked Washington, University of Washington, is losing to Stanford 31-26. So we'll see how that one turns out. They've got about 4 minutes left there. Right now, number 13, BYU, is leading Coastal, number 18th ranked Coastal Carolina University, 14-13. By the way, Coastal Carolina, which is a school that nobody ever heard of in terms of
anything.
Yeah. They have flourished because Wilmington is very beautiful. It's a coastal community, a beachfront community, and so people want to go to school there. It's easy to recruit. I think that's why that is. It's kind of like Central Florida. University of Central Florida has also become something of a football contender. Meanwhile, number 12, Indiana, 14 over number 16, Wisconsin. It's 14-6 was the final there. Number 2, Notre Dame crushes Syracuse 45-21. Number 15, Oklahoma State lost to TCU 29-22. North Carolina, ranked number 17th, defeated Western Carolina 49-9. Number 21, Marshall, and I had not even realized that they were in contention, but the Thundering Herd, I believe they're called, right? But number 21, Marshall, however, lost to Rice 20-0.
Wow.
And
Rice?
Yeah, Rice. Rice of all people, they're now 2-2. So who ever heard of Rice? It's been a long time since they were any kind of contender in football. But it's scoreless. They've just kicked off Oregon at California. At 7:30, Clemson, ranked number 3, and with only one loss, which was to Notre Dame, of course. But Clemson kicks off at Virginia Tech, and of course at 8 o'clock, the undefeated number 1 ranked Alabama, University of Alabama Crimson Tide, plays at Baton Rouge against some team down there.
Oh, well, okay.
In Louisiana.
At least
you may have heard of them.
The food's good down there.
Yes, good food, but we're going to beat them good.
But speaking of our misspent youth and our time in college, it was, well, let me put it like this. When I was a 17-year-old freshman, I got my first gig on the radio at WRVU, the Vanderbilt campus station. And actually, I wound up working at quite a few of the AM and FM stations in Nashville. I actually worked at a television station, but they always kept me on the backside of the camera. Well, I had a first-class radio telephone operator's license, which meant I could also run the transmitter. So at a low-budget UHF station, well, never mind.
Yes, I know.
We've been cleaning the basement at Stately Hoag Manor, and my son has been bringing me all sorts of interesting boxes of important papers to go through. And I've been finding things like pictures from my honeymoon and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But brought up a box of 45 RPM records, DJ copies left over from when I was doing radio. And like the newest records in this thing were like 50 years old.
Yes. Wow.
And I put the top four records that happened to be on the top record from each of the four stacks of records that were in the box up in a picture on Hogwash. And they are, let me see. MacArthur Park, Richard Harris, The Boxer, Simon and Garfunkel, Question by the Moody Blues.
Moody Blues. I didn't realize that was 50 years old. That kind of blew me away because I didn't even discover the Moody Blues until college, in the 80s. Never mind.
There was an album track. Stacey and I were talking about that cut before we went on tonight, and he was talking about listening to it on FM when he was in college, and I pointed out there was an album track then. Okay. I remember, these are DJ copies. Actually, I was playing that one on an FM station. But anyway, which is weird because it's a mono. It's the mono 45. They came out with stereo versions of the 45s for FM disc jockeys, but I don't have that one. And then a copy of He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother by the Hollies. And, you know, it was kind of interesting to put those up. And then when I was putting together the agenda for tonight, I'm thinking about, if you think about the 60s, and these are 68 for the Boxer, 69 for He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, and MacArthur Park, and 70 for Question. If you think about what the societies they're talking about and how things are working out for people and not working out for people, it's an excellent lead in to one of Stacy's posts this week. Basically, the planters and their plans and the cake they left out in the rain.
Oh, yeah. By the way, that song sucked, man. The MacArthur
It's actually two songs spliced together.
It's terrible. I don't care.
It is one of the worst things ever put ever on recorded. Vinyl.
But it runs over 7 minutes, so you can make it down the hall and back to the restroom.
Yeah.
Doing Loan Me a Dime. I mean, for heaven's sake.
Well, that isn't going to work in 1968.
Right, yeah.
Well,
the only other
thing we had that was like that. Well, we had two other records like that. One was the album track version of Light My Fire, which ran almost 7 minutes, and of course, Alice's Restaurant, which is like 17 minutes and 19 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyways, to get to more political matters. The flashback on my blog, theothermccain.com, the headline on the item was The Planners and Their Plans, and you've got a picture there of the old Cabrini Green housing project in Chicago. Now, if you're my age, the very mention of Cabrini Green calls to mind memories of how liberalism's war on poverty ultimately ended in catastrophic defeat.
We had a war on poverty, and poverty won, is the
right. As Ronald Reagan said, during the 1960s, we declared war on poverty. Poverty won. I quote the Wikipedia page about Cabrini Green. At its peak, Cabrini Green was home to 15,000 people, mostly living in mid and high-rise apartment buildings, totaling 3,607 units. Over the years, crime and neglect created hostile living conditions for many residents. Boy, that's a nice euphemistic statement.
Oh, look, I had family in Chicago back then, and there were certain parts of town that you just didn't even think about going near. Guess what?
We could start humming Jim Croce songs here.
Yeah. And one of the things that, humming Jim Croce songs. Oh, yeah. The south side of Chicago is the baddest part of town.
Baddest part of town.
Yeah. Well, anyways, but this was the heyday when Cabrini Green was built during the heyday of liberalism, and back in the day, right, to criticize, to speak a word of criticism about federally funded public housing, well, that was just racist, right? And finally, in the 1990s, people began to realize that just stacking poor people up to the sky and creating this concentration of poverty by design, federally subsidized poverty, was a bad idea, and it was bad for the people that you were supposedly helping.
Yeah, I mean, at the point where we were having a discussion about, you know, it got to be the point where Cabrini Greens was at the point where it was a push to whether to maintain it anymore or to replace it, and they had a meeting with the people who lived there, and the people started chanting, tear it down.
Yes, and they ultimately did.
Tear it down.
If you're old enough to remember the 90s, and I think we all are.
Oh, yeah.
You would watch television, the local TV news, as they would demolish the local public housing project. And we there are video clips out there, compilations of all these public housing towers just collapsing into rubble, symbolizing the recognition that we had 30 years ago, right? 25, 30 years ago, people began to realize that this approach to dealing with poverty was a disaster.
Yes.
And,
if you subsidize something, you're going to get more of it.
Right, right, right. And so when you start subsidizing poverty, right? Ta-da.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't just that. If you think about it, these towers, people were trapped. I mean, seriously, getting in or out, you have only two ways in and out, the elevators and the fire stairs. And I'm here to tell you that you can't get past the criminals.
Right.
Honest, decent people were absolutely imprisoned there. They couldn't leave to go to work. They were terrified. They lived in terror. How are you supposed to live like that? And it doesn't take very many bad people to make that sort of situation unbearable.
Right. And one of the things, there is a great book called The Future Once Happened Here, if you haven't read it, it's about the failure of urban policy, liberal urban policy. And one of the points that has been made, and Thomas Sowell has also made this point, one of the points is that a lot of this was called slum clearance, urban renewal. Okay, the idea, well, we've got to tear down these slums and we're going to build these shiny new apartment towers, and that will solve the problem. Here is the thing, though, is that privately owned, quote unquote, slum housing at least offers the opportunity, right, for commercial enterprise. For example, just to give you an example, okay, you think of some, you know, Victorian era home, right? A larger home that has been carved up into units, three or four units. And as usually happens, because these big mansions, you know, they were built for big families, you know, and nowadays. But one of the things that would happen is somebody would be running a barber shop out of the basement, or they would have some small business there, or at least the person who owned the house, right, would sublet rooms. And this was a type of economic enterprise that took place because it was privately owned. Once you have government housing, right, no commercial activity can be done there. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what kind of commercial activity happens when you make commercial activity illegal?
Well, I would say put that in your pipe and smoke it, but they might arrest me.
Right. So drugs and crime flourished in the projects, and all of this is go ahead.
Well, Nashville, where I grew up, did not make the mistake of building high rise apartments. They built everything as one story long townhouse sorts of things. Now, they weren't particularly nice and spiffy, but at least you were, you know, in a townhouse sort of situation where people weren't stacked up. But Nashville's wasn't remotely the density of a place like Chicago or Philadelphia. The interesting thing is that if you went on the east side of 12th Avenue South, those older houses got bulldozed and turned into urban renewal. If you went on the west side of 12th Avenue South, those old houses wound up becoming some of the top recording studios in the country because they were developed commercially.
Right. Well,
it's interesting. Guess which was a predominantly white and which was a predominantly black neighborhood.
Right.
Well, I would like to point out that in San Francisco, I lived in, God, the mid-80s, at the corner in an awful little apartment building at the corner of Hayes and Webster, right across from what was called the Pink Palace Projects. Since then, that area has the projects are gone, and it's now Hayes Valley, and it's really quite an interesting, funky, pleasant little area. Nothing like it used to be. Just trust me. I've got some stories that are really funny, but not very pleasant if you were going through them.
Well, let me tell the story that I tell in the blog post, okay?
Yes.
The last resident to leave the last high-rise tower at Cabrini Green before it was demolished in 2010 was a woman named Annie Ricks, born in Escambia County, Alabama, in 1956. Ricks was 10 when she moved to Chicago with her family. By the time she moved into Cabrini Green in 1989, Ricks had 8 children, and she gave birth to another 5 children while she lived there. The Cabrini Green site was redeveloped with a mix of luxury condos and quote-unquote affordable housing in what reporters described as a planned mixed-income neighborhood. And there was an interesting coda to the story this year when a 9-year-old boy who lived in the affordable section of the redeveloped Cabrini Green was shot dead. Janari Ricks was the grandson of Annie Ricks. The man charged with Janari's murder, 39-year-old Daryl Johnson, opened fire at, quote, a group of people behind the townhomes on the 900 block of North Cambridge Avenue. According to prosecutors, Johnson spent 4 years in prison for a 2005 conviction on carjacking and weapons charges and served 2 years probation for a 2002 conviction for aggravated battery. It appears that neither the shooter nor his intended target live in Cabrini Green, although they grew up there. Janari is the fifth, or was at the time, the fifth child aged 10 or younger to be shot and killed in Chicago this year. Joe Biden got nearly 75% of the vote in Cook County, Illinois. And his agenda regarding law enforcement is mainly an exercise in blaming systemic racism for everything wrong in the black community. Interestingly enough, the community where Annie Ricks was born has a larger black community percentage-wise than Chicago. Escambia County, Alabama is 32% black, whereas Cook County, Illinois is only 25% black. And while Biden easily won Chicago, Donald Trump got 68% of the vote in Escambia County, where perhaps not coincidentally, children don't get shot to death as a routine matter. Now, I went on to talk about the concept of magic dirt theory. Yeah. Which was a phrase originated by the blogger Vox Day. And so the idea is that poverty and other social problems, including crime, are caused by geographical location.
Well, there's something to be said about D.C.
Yeah. Well, but anyways, but yes. The idea is that poor people, the reason they're poor is because they live on tragic dirt, right? Whereas the people where the schools are safe and the kids all have above average SAT scores, well, that's the magic dirt. So all you've got to do is to transport the people from the tragic dirt to the magic dirt, that will solve the problem.
That's the kind of idiotic liberal idiocy that you were writing about also in the week.
Yeah.
But all these wonderful solutions, like getting rid of the police, are going to interrupt the cycles of violence. You know, what we, I think the thing you talked about was quoting this one woman that you were quoting about, she's talking about proven strategies to interrupt the cycles of violence and investing in community-based safety strategies.
Yes.
Like
a few months ago, the name Lisa Bender became sort of controversial. Lisa Bender was the president of the Minneapolis City Council when she was being interviewed on CNN and said she could imagine a police-free future.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, she's going to invest in community-based strategies. I have pointed out in your comment section that during the first half of the 19th century, the UK began experimenting with a community-based safety strategy that involved hiring members of the community to keep watch and maintain order, to locate and detain suspected criminals, and to bring accused criminals before the courts. Now, apparently this scheme has enjoyed some modest success in the UK, so maybe Minneapolis would want to.
Right. You know, by the way, the bodies, go ahead. The British, the fact that,
What was that, Diana?
I was going to say Minneapolis is actually suggesting that neighborhoods turn into heavily armed, mutually suspicious enclaves. That's going to work out well.
Yeah, Yugoslavia worked out real well. What I was going to say is one of the things, if you pay attention, which is very difficult, if you pay attention to what is being said by the Black Lives Matter movement, one of their claims, and it's absolutely preposterous, the idea that modern police forces originated as slave catching patrols. Well, this is absolutely false because the first professional police force,
1828, London Metropolitan Police, Sir Robert Peel founded them while he was Home Secretary.
Right. And so this idea.
The second one is the South Australia State Police Force. Now, Australia did not have a lot of slavery.
Yeah.
But not a lot of slavery.
Well, South Australia was the part of Australia that didn't have convicts, and they thought they were going to get by without a police force for a while. And then some of the people started coming in from the neighboring states, and they figured out.
But this idea of tracing everything in America to slavery and so therefore everything is racist, it's just insane. But the result of Lisa Bender's agenda in Minneapolis is that there has been a 63% increase in the number of homicides this year compared to last year, and the year's not over yet.
Well, you know, that's not the only place where the Democrats have caused a little bit of crime. Including in things like vote counting. But, of course, that's not true because there's no evidence other than the fact that we've got video that's showing up now. So, obviously, we're deniers. We deny all the stuff that the left brings up. The thing is, it's a principle that I learned in engineering school. And when somebody makes an extraordinary claim, they need to offer extraordinary evidence to support their claim. For example, if I say, I saw the sun come up this morning, well, you know, that's not an extraordinary claim. So all I would really have to do to prove to you that I was awake at the time the sun came up and the sky wasn't too cloudy, which, you know, those are not extraordinary things to bring up. But if I said, I saw the sun rise in the west this morning, I better have some really good evidence, or you could suspect that I'm a liar.
Or that you're insane, but
or both. But the thing is that the Democrats are making an extraordinary claim about how well Joe Biden did in the election, and they are not offering any evidence to support those sorts of claims, whereas the claims of fraud, maybe the evidence is bogus, but there's hundreds of affidavits now, people swearing this. There's the video evidence from the count in
We have actually seen the obituaries of people who allegedly voted for Joe Biden.
Well, I mean, it's one thing for somebody gets their absentee ballot, sends it in on time, and dies the day before election day. Mm-mm. There's going to be some of that, and that's not it. that's going to be lost in the noise. The problem is the obituary of the guy who died in 1963.
not quite that reasonable. Well, no. I've seen the obituary of a guy who died in 2006.
I've seen there's a guy who voted in Michigan who was born in the 1820s.
Right. Okay. So
my favorite being the Joe the boxer. The most fit, the world champion.
Joe Lewis.
Joe Lewis. That's correct.
Yeah.
Sorry, name would not come.
No, I think it was Frazier. Joe Frazier. I'm sorry. Yeah. Joe Frazier voted in Philadelphia, allegedly.
Frazier's been dead for a while.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, but we're the deniers, right? Okay. On the other, and the sort of roasting we're getting on social media is, you know, and no wonder people are saying something has to be done about it. Meanwhile, Facebook's getting sued by the feds.
Yeah.
But it's not the lawsuit you were expecting, right? It doesn't have anything to do with anything other than their employment practices. It seems that Facebook has been illegally hiring people with H-1B temporary work visas instead of hiring Americans that were qualified for the jobs. And that's, again, the law. So the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice has sued them. You know, you can't illegally prefer to recruit, consider, and hire temporary people with visas instead of Americans. It's just against the law. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Google's getting sued about various other things. And I made the observation on Hogwash that it's rarely the obvious fault that finally trips up all these self-important folks in the world. And you might want to remember that it was income tax evasion that got Capone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
but the world's gone crazy.
Yes. And,
I mean, and look, you did this post about how bizarre things have got.
Yeah, a sort of running gag with Ed Driscoll at Pajamas Media. We've descended into some sort of bizarre hell world in which blank is a voice of sanity. Okay, and so. Over the months, and I don't know how far back, I started going through the archives at InstaButt.
I think the first one was Matt Talabi about 2 years ago.
But in other words, where liberals are actually objecting to liberalism, okay, and so the most recent this week, we've descended into some sort of bizarre hell world in which Matthew Iglesias is a voice of sanity. Now, if you don't know who Matthew Iglesias is. He was with the American Prospect for many years and was one of the founders of Vox, right? Okay, and so
But I mean, you know, he's an interesting contradiction because he isn't all that open minded, but he acts as if he's so open minded his brain really did fall out.
It's an interesting story of who Matthew Iglesias is. I'll just mention that he went to Harvard.
Strike three.
Yeah. Well, anyways, what happened is that this week he said on Twitter that defund the police is a bad idea. And the left, I want to say they went crazy, but they were already crazy. So they start chewing into Matthew Iglesias, and I have to remind my readers at theothermccain.com that the reason why he might be so in favor of the police is that in 2013, he spent $1.2 million for a condo near Logan Circle in Northwest DC. This was part of the gentrification in our nation's capital, where an incentive program for first-time home buyers enabled a lot of white yuppies, to say it frankly, to purchase Washington real estate at unfavorable terms. This caused a wave of gentrification, and this has been going on in many other cities, by the way. They figured out, hey, there are a lot of people who might like to live near where they work rather than have to commute. So what happened in Washington, D.C. has happened in many other cities around in this kind of gentrification. Well, this happened coincidentally at a time when violent crime rates in the United States were down to their lowest level since the 1960s. But then about 5 years ago, of course, we had the Black Lives Matter movement erupted. I don't think that's a coincidence, by the way.
No, but it was actually about 10 years ago during the middle of the first Obama term, a term that crime really started shooting up again because of lack of prosecutions.
Well, I want to say this is that if you're like me and you know, nowadays, because by the way, and I got some blowback in the comments on this, by the way, I had written next to nothing about the controversy over the election, because mm-hmm. if I pay too much attention to it, it'll drive me nuts. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think
drive.
A lot of what?
Drive.
Okay.
Provoke your madness to new levels.
For the sake of my mental health, I am trying not to pay attention to it. And I think there are probably a lot of other Americans who are straining with this unreality that we're living in.
So it's not basically I'm looking at all the absurd claims that are being made on both sides of the election theft issue. And it's like, you know what? It's going to work out the way it works out. I really don't have any control over it.
Right.
Meanwhile, I can watch and see the humorous parts of life go by. And I had a wonderful, I'm not making this up, you know, post this week. Che Guevara. You may remember Che Guevara.
Yes. AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
She's gone capitalist on us.
Yes,
she is.
She is
selling Tax the Rich t-shirts. Actually, they're on pre-order. Tax the Rich t-shirts for $58. Okay. Now,
at some point, surely somebody should have said to her gently, very gently, Allie, hun, Tax the Rich and $58. There's a disconnect here.
Well, the best pushback I saw was from our paper of record, the Babylon Bee. They said that they had a thing about her selling Tax the Rich caviar for $10,000 a tin. which, you know, it would better be real good fish eggs. On the other hand, if the listener would rather support general capitalism and save a few bucks at the same time, you can go to the Hogwash store and buy a Hogwash Team Leak Spittle sweatshirt for only $35.99. And you can find that over at Hogwash.com. And while you're looking for deals on the interwebs, one of the great deals is supporting your local blogger. And I hear there's a rumor of a yellow button someplace.
Yes, folks. If you will go to theothermccain.com, and I hope you go there frequently, at theothermccain.com, near the top of the center column is a yellow button that has one word on it, donate. And if you will click that button, it will take you to my PayPal account where you can contribute to the support of the blog and also to the podcast. And also the most important part of hitting the tip jar, I should say, of contributing to support the blog is that it makes my wife happy when I have money and can help to pay the bills. So anyway, so that's how I, the tip jar, I've been funding this thing. And I remember speaking of Valdosta, by the way. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Valdosta, I noticed that our old friend Ali and former co-defendant Ali Akbar, now Ali Alexander, is down there with his Stop the Steal team. Mm-hmm. And it was, 8 years ago now that I had to vamoose under a situation and the month that I had to relocate my family in 1 month off the tip jar, $11,000, 1 month. And that's how the fight against Team Kimberlin. So this is called crowdfunding. Okay. Small donations add up to significant amount, so that if you can contribute $3, $5, $10, whatever, go over to the other McCain, click on the yellow button. And meanwhile, over at my good friend John Hoag's site, hoagwash.com,
you will find occasional posts where I say hit some other blogger's tip jar because, well, and as a matter of fact, the first time I blogged anything about Stacy was when he was having to make that move because his family was being threatened. And I kicked in $50 and encouraged other people to contribute as well. But I also have I don't have a yellow button. I have a tip jar icon over there in the sidebar. Click on that. You'll be taken to my PayPal account. You can also click on the icon of the silly hat and be taken off to the Hoag Wash store. Great place to get sweatshirts and stocking stuffers. It's Christmas coming up. And speaking of your Christmas shopping, you can also some of that via the links to Amazon that you see on various blogs. Those of us who are members of the Amazon affiliates program actually make a small commission when you do the shopping through the links you'll find
at no extra cost.
No, it didn't cost you anything. Amazon is just helping support things that way. So that's what we've got going there. Meanwhile, we have to remind you of the five most important words in the English language.
Hit the freaking tip jar.
Thank you very much, Diana. And by the way, to update you a little bit on the college football scoreboard, BYU in the third quarter leads Coastal Carolina 17-13, while California still in the first quarter, nearing the end of the first quarter, Berkeley, the University of California, the Golden Bears, is that what
they're called? Yes, the Golden Bears.
The Golden Bears lead Oregon 7-3. So that's your, just to keep you up on that. But one of the things, what I was starting to say about law enforcement.
Yeah.
Before we got to the middle of that, is that I cover crime a lot. I've always found these wild and crazy.
If it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that when I was growing up, my mother loved to watch the detective shows, Perry Mason and those kind of shows on TV, and so. And so I kind of fell in love with the true crime genre. And in college, as a matter of fact, in my freshman comp class, one of the assigned texts was Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, which is the ultimate true crime story. Well, and
one of the few movies that's approaches being as good as the book, though.
The book is fascinating, but the point being that paying attention to crime is something that I have always done. And if you watch on A&E, The First 48, which is an award-winning detective show showing real-life homicide detectives solving real-life homicides, okay? And one of the things you know about this is that nowadays technology plays a large role in solving crimes, particularly murder, carjacking, kidnapping, armed robbery, that surveillance video is almost ubiquitous.
Apparently there were cameras in the counting areas in Fulton County.
We'll get to that. But what I was going to say is, yes, video in Fulton County. Yeah, there's a crime going on there. But the video evidence, we now have national databases of DNA and fingerprints that are computer things. The patrol cars now, many of them, are equipped with these little scanners that will scan your tag. And if you have an expired tag, or if there are warrants out for you, or if the car is stolen,
or you didn't get it smogged.
What?
If you didn't get to, how you
have
to get.
That's actually a crime now.
Yes.
But anyways, if you, so technology is helping solve crime, and technology is one of the reasons why the crime rate fell so sharply over 20 years. Now, policy had something to do with it. What was known as broken windows policing, the policy that was enacted in New York City under Rudy Giuliani's mayorship, and that sort of what they did in New York has been studied and replicated many communities. We had more effective law enforcement. And
you also had one other thing happening that a lot of people ignore because it's politically incorrect. Beginning in 1987 with Florida adopting shall issue concealed carry permits,
yes,
people started shooting back.
Yep.
Yeah, and but what I'm saying is, and I'm trying to make the connection between Matthew Iglesias and his liberal objections to defund the police and where the Black Lives Matter movement started. Okay, if you remember what happened, it started with Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Right. And there was this claim, right, that he had been gunned down, hands up, don't shoot. Right. That made the rounds. That story, that lie, made the rounds. And then we had video showing Michael Brown doing a strong armed robbery at a convenience store immediately beforehand. So this quote unquote honor student, right?
Yeah.
Okay, they're going to show you his eighth grade graduation picture and tell you that he was an innocent angel. No, he had robbed, done this. He had stolen what they call wraps for cigar things to make a spliff. So he was. And when the police officer tried to arrest him, he tried to grab the gun. Now, this. This led to body cams being, all the police getting body cams. And so now we have video evidence, right, in all of these crimes. And what was happening was this. When you hear the phrase mass incarceration, mass incarceration, they're locking up people for nonviolent drug offenses, blah, 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 blah. No, that's what they pleaded guilty to, ma'am. Okay. When you get charged with robbery, kidnapping, car theft, or whatever, you can plead it down. Okay. And so there were a lot of people in there, and everyone in prison has some story to tell you. some sob story about why they're there. And so this claim that law enforcement was racist is connected to the fact that law enforcement was becoming more effective. And now the gains of 20 years, you know, from the mid 90s onward, okay, are being thrown away for the sake of political correctness. And you want, mark my words, over the next 4 years, say if Joe Biden succeeds in the crime of becoming president, this will be the story. And this will drive the resistance to the Biden administration. Well, yeah. I'm sorry that I started ranting there, yes, John.
You did, and thrown us way off. But we'll see what we can do about recovery.
Oh, well, we can go a little long.
Well, actually, the next topic is a good law enforcement phrase. Nothing to see here. Move along.
Yeah, right.
The Tennessee Star, which is an interesting outfit, had a report earlier this week that a guy by the name of Arik Thompson was working for Dominion Voting Systems as a technician, one of their representatives in Fulton County, Georgia. Now, Thompson is also Kamala Harris's presidential campaign's official photographer. And he describes her as a long-term client. By the way, I'm seeing reports that there was a server crash the day that report came out, and that something, they're having to fix something down in Fulton County. So that's the sort of thing that happens. But, you know, the interesting thing that's going on is that one of the things is the differential voting scheme where one candidate might get 1.2 votes, 1.3 votes, 1.5 votes, and then you round down the other candidate. And it struck me, I wrote a post called Enforcing Baker versus Carr. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with what happened in Tennessee back in the 60s, Charlie Baker was a Republican in Memphis. And Tennessee was completely one-sided Democrat state back then. And it hadn't been, the Senate districts were drawn geographically and hadn't been redrawn since before the First World War. And he sued to saying that it was an equal protection problem. And typically the courts had said, well, House legislatures apportion themselves is not justiciable. That's political. We don't get involved. But when Baker versus Carr got to the Supreme Court, they ruled that, no, that's justiciable. And they sent the matter back to the district court in the Western District of Tennessee for that suit. And then in the meantime, a couple of other suits came up, and the Supremes ruled that, no, you have to apportion based on one man, one vote. Now, that actually isn't tied to Baker versus Carr, but in a lot of civics classes, they say Baker versus Carr is the one man, one vote thing. Well, you know, one man, one vote isn't what you get when you have differential weighting of votes. So it's going to be interesting to see if that is actually a wedge that can be used against, in particular, it looks like Arizona.
The whole business about Dominion voting, it's based in Toronto, Canada. We're using Canadian machines.
Well, but it's Venezuelan software.
Right.
It gets better. Evidently, at least in some cases, say the six cities where it really counts, it looks like the data got moved overseas and then back here, which makes absolutely no sense.
There's an international tie-in between Dominion and some other companies. One of them is a Spanish company that does voting systems. And apparently Dominion gets their server hosting via that. And the servers are in Germany.
Right. And as someone noted during all of this controversy, is that the chain of custody, right, has been completely lost in this process. And so it is impossible but it's extraordinarily difficult to audit the election results. What they have done with these voting machines has been very difficult. It makes it very difficult to disprove any claim of cheating.
But if you can't disprove it, you can't prove it either.
Right. And ambiguous.
Well, no, it's not. Because if you destroy evidence, that's called spoliation. And then there's a legal principle, if that evidence has been spoiled that way, that you assume that it was that the other person's claim is correct.
Except that where this ends up is that you have, no matter what, you have both sides of this election. Doesn't matter who wins at this point. Neither side is accepting the legitimacy of this election. That's the problem.
Right. And it's happened strictly because of what the left, especially the Democratic Party, has done to taint what was going on. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting. Basically, pretend for an instance that Biden is declared the winner. I found a couple of terms on the interwebs, and I've spliced them together in a synthesis of how to refer to him. His fraudulency, Joe Biden, and that's Biden spelled X-I-D-E-N.
Cheating?
Well, Cheating, yes, but I mean, but I think you got the drift there.
Yeah.
And since you're down in Georgia, you might appreciate a meme I found on the internet and republished at Hogwash. It is a picture, it's a still from the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail. It's Eric mm-hmm. Idle as the cart driver, and he's saying, mm-hmm. bring out your votes.
And bring it to boots. Oh, God, any minute now.
So. Well, I labeled it Democrats campaigning for the Georgia special election.
Oh.
Yeah. The problem with this situation, Diana said it doesn't matter who wins. Well, it matters very much who wins,
she's talking just about
in terms of the undermining of the credibility of the system. Yes, whoever is declared the winner, there will be doubt.
Although it's interesting, according to the stuff I saw at Rasmussen, it was a Gallup poll actually, though. 30% of the Democrats think it's a stolen election.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Last week that was Rasmussen.
Rasmussen.
Yeah.
Gallup duplicated that?
Well, no, I think they were reporting on what Gallup found, but it's interesting. If 30% of the Democrats think it's stolen mm-hmm. for their guy, right? Right now, I mean, I think the latest figures I've seen, 47% of the electorate believes it's a stolen election.
Yeah, and this goes back, by the way, it goes back to a lot of what happened. Another poll we saw during the election campaign that even people who are planning to vote for Joe Biden, a substantial percentage of them thought that Trump would win anyway. I remember going back to 2000, that 37-day drama down in Florida, but that was one state. And the difference between what's happening right now and what happened 20 years ago is that you had one state that was razor thin, a margin of less than 500 votes.
And only two counties. Where they were doing the counting.
Well, it was Broward and Palm Beach.
Right.
Yeah. In those two counties, that was where the recount became a drama that finally the Supreme Court said, I'm sorry, you passed the safe harbor, that we have to have, there must be an end to this. And so, and what they were trying to do was trying to do what they eventually did in Minnesota to Norm Coleman, right, to elect Al Franken, is that we're just going to have an endless recount. We're going to recount and recount and recount until the Democrat wins. Yes. And the Supreme Court, Bush v. Gore, said, no, you're not. We're not going to play that game here. It's over. And of course, Democrats claimed that they were cheated and Bush lied and everything, all this stuff that went on. Well, it's boomeranged back around on them, of course. But what's happening this time is that there are six states, right, that were, fairly close enough that people believe that they were within the margin of theft, as you often said on election night during our podcast.
But what caused that sudden shutdown and then spike later in the vote counting was the fact that the elections weren't as close as they thought, and the differential voting that they programmed in wasn't adequate.
Right.
And so they then had to come up with just flat out fraudulent ballots.
Yeah.
And they had them printed up ready to go, but they had to stop, get people out so they could, well, you can see what happened in the Georgia video.
Right, right. And so so the problem you have, one of the causes of, one of the things that causes mental illness is cognitive dissonance, the stress of the difference between what you see or what you believe to be true and what is in the feedback that is coming back around to you.
Yeah, well, I mean, but see, that's also the basis of humor. When you see something that's true, that contradicts your expectations, that's the basis of a good belly laugh. And that's the basis of Rule 5 that Alinsky has, which is, that ridicule is our most important weapon. These people can tolerate being accused of being nefarious. Matter of fact, they might even think that that's a badge of honor, or that they're doing well, but they can't tolerate being laughed at. And so that's the reason for the power of Rule 5. That's the reason why I talk about his fraudulency. That's the reason why I think that meme of bring out your votes is funny. However,
the left can't meme. The left cannot meme.
Yeah, what's his name? Help me. Doggone it. Now I'm breaking
down.
Well,
lots of people say the left.
Benny Johnson. Benny Johnson's always going, the left can't meme.
Well, they can't. And they can't because that's the same reason why they can't take a joke.
Mm-hmm.
Because humor is cognitive dissonance that you can survive. And they're at the point where their cognitive dissonance is so great that all they can do is scream and cry. That's crazy. Crazy people are dangerous. And speaking of the other Rule 5 that we talk about, Stacey, you finally got Rule 5 right on a crazy person this week.
Yeah, all right. Well, yes. Crazy people are dangerous, as I often say. And one of my early on in going back to 2009, as a matter of fact, I created the How to Get a Million Hits on Your Tip Jar. How to Get a Million Hits on Your Blog.
Well, we'll settle for a million hits on the tip jar.
I'd settle for that too. But anyways, how to get a million hits on your blog. And one of those rules was what I call Rule 5. Everybody loves a pretty girl.
Girl here that you've got at the top of the post is most people would think she's pretty.
John really likes this one. A woman in a viral rant. A woman whose rant on social media went viral has blamed QAnon and mental illness for her breakdown in July. Melissa Rain Lively was a successful Phoenix businesswoman, CEO of her own marketing and public relations firm, The Brand Consortium. She, quote, had developed a reputation for living a posh lifestyle and organizing red carpet events, business openings, fashion shows, and charity events in Arizona, close quote. But that was before she cracked up and went viral. In July, and she recorded a video of herself destroying a COVID-19 mask display at a Target store in Phoenix. In social media posts, Lively claimed to be spokeswoman for QAnon. Eventually, her husband called 911 and she got hauled off for psychiatric treatment. Yeah. Quote, I was canceled. My business was gone overnight. I got sucked into QAnon because I was desperate, lonely, scared, and searching for answers, she recently said. She said, it's so crazy, this cult ideology it has, speaking of QAnon. The more you read into it, the more you freak out. Somebody in my mental capacity who was having a traumatic experience, it was the fuel to the fire and set the whole thing off. Now, I will say about this is that she is an extremely attractive woman, and you could see how she could be a social media star. Why was she having such stress in July? And I'll tell you why. Because her business, right, was event planning. Okay. And marketing. And as they said, she organized things, you know, charity events, fashion shows, business openings, things like that. She was the go-to lady if you were having some upscale posh event that you needed marketing, publicity, and organize. She was an event planner. Well, what happened with the COVID shutdown, right? Okay. This lockdown mentality had made that kind of business thing. And so she was faced with the loss not only of her livelihood, but of her social sphere. Okay, and she no longer had people. And she went nuts. And as I've said before, there are a lot of seemingly normal people out there barely hanging on to sanity, who may be just one bad day away from going bonkers completely. So plan accordingly. Speaking of plans, we are reaching the end of the podcast. We will be back next Saturday, 7 p.m. Eastern, as usual.
Good night, Stacy. Good night, Diana.
Good night, John. Good night.
And Stacey. We are out of here. Mr. Breeze.